Bram, it's a pleasure. You're on the pod. Welcome.
Yes, we made it, man. I mean, we've been talking for over a year, I think.
So yes, a couple of different podcasting opportunities, but we've made it on a call. And yes. I like these days to just kind of get straight into it. So why is Bitcoin for millennials?
Ooh, I think there's different answers to that. Also different answers that I learned along the way while doing my podcast. I'll share two things. Like why I started was actually because, you know, I've been in Bitcoin for 10 years. I always share, like, I bought at 300, I sold at 4,000, you know, the understanding goes up and down. I did all the crypto stuff. And eventually I realized Bitcoin is the only thing to pay attention to. And what actually I think truly got me there is understanding that the current financial system is flawed in the sense that, you know, the programmatic currency debasement is unstoppable. So, you know, your money is going to lose value into the future, you know, into perpetuity, basically. And when I heard Saif Dinamous talk about the future, he talked about, like, the future is uncertain for everyone, right? So, like, you don't know if you're alive tomorrow, literally. So for everyone, the future is uncertain. And so basically everything we do in our lives is a choice in taking certain risk, right? Whatever job you do or whatever venture you do or, you know, stuff like that. So you go out and you take on more risk every day. And eventually that what you do and what you earn a reward for, which, yeah, you could describe as economic energy. If you want to store that towards the future because you want to build something towards the future or start, yeah, well, whatever that is, right? Like a home or a business or a family, you have to be able to save towards the future in order to collect the capital to actually deploy that again and do something with it. But because that what you're using to save for the future is constantly losing its value, this uncertainty towards the future actually increases constantly. So while you're thinking you're doing the right thing by saving, as we've all been taught, you're actually not lowering this uncertainty towards the future, right? Like having plans towards the future, having hope and being enthusiastic about the future. It actually, without many people actually realizing, right, like it actually increases your uncertainty towards the future. And so once I realized that that mechanism basically exists and that in a parallel to that, Bitcoin exists with an absolute scarcity, absolute transparency, absolute predictability, as in, you know, one Bitcoin is always one Bitcoin. It cannot be debased, etc. I realized that I was actually operating in a system that wasn't designed or isn't designed for me as the individual that cares most about my individual life, or my family, etc., to actually lower that uncertainty towards the future. And that was a big aha moment for me. And that came pretty late, I'd say maybe like 3.5-ish years ago or something, you know, after being in Bitcoin for a long time. But like understanding that kind of like the financial and economic elements as to why Bitcoin exists was actually my biggest eye opener. And when I started talking with people about that, I realized that nobody is paying it. Nobody, at least in my, you know, vicinity, people that I regard highly, who are smart, they have money. Some people sold companies. Yeah, they are totally unaware of that. And when you then realize that, if you look a bit longer into the future, right, retirement and stuff like that, if you actually start calculating how many units of your currency you need in order to have, let's say, a basic retirement, you end up with ridiculous amounts that are totally not achievable for the general person. And so I feel that, or what I found is that it's actually a very practical and real problem, but many people aren't aware of that. And so the very short summary that I have of that is, yeah, your pension doesn't really exist, right? Like there is no real retirement for you as how you conceptualize it. Or maybe how you see your parents still, you know, like they are okay. Although, for example, for my mom, I still think like, yeah, I sometimes tell her, like, I don't know if the money is there. I hope it's there, you know, and you get to live your retirement. You know, I have to figure out my own thing. So I hope it's there, but I don't think it's there. And that's why I'm talking about this in general, right? Also doing the podcast. Like, this is a very pressing issue. Like, everything you're doing today, all the risk and choices you are making today in order to earn a reward for your time and energy is not only to live for today, but also kind of like to plan for the future. And I think because we are using a money that's constantly debased, like that opportunity to think towards the future, to have a positive outlook towards the future, you know, being enthusiastic about building something towards the future, that's really being taken from us. And yeah, what people need is a better money. And I've come to the rational conclusion that that is Bitcoin.
I love it, Bram. All of that speaks very, very strongly to me. And in some ways, it's hard to know exactly like where to take the conversation exactly next, because I'd like to kind of pick apart literally all of what you just said. I'm going to take it somewhere which I kind of thought about before. I'd love to learn about where you came from before that. And so I actually like yourself. I first bought some Bitcoin. It was a couple of $100 a coin in 2015. And that bull run pushed up to whatever it did, a couple thousand. And you're like, wow, I'm so clever. Let me sell some. And then I heard about the block size problem. Exactly. Oh, maybe it's all going to zero. So let me get rid of it.
Yep.
And in summary, I didn't know what I was buying. I had absolutely no idea what I was buying. And it wasn't until 2020 when Mr. Saylor, like I could call myself a Saylorite if there was such a thing, started buying it with his treasury reserve as a stock listed company, that I as an investor really took notice. I was like, that's a big deal. What does this mean? And all this money printing that was going on. But you're right. It's the idea of time preference. It's basically, it's a niche part of Austrian economics that suddenly makes so much more sense. You're like, oh, hang on. If I save in this sound money, I can make better decisions in the future. Mm-hmm. And so the lower time preference you can behave, the easier it is to accumulate capital. And when you're living on a fiat standard, that's just not possible, at least from a savings perspective.
Yeah.
Anyway, where I want to go with this, which I think is cool, is, you know, you talk about on your, at least from what I've read in your bios and stuff, exiting businesses in the past. It wouldn't surprise me at all if you spent time in kind of fiat startup land, which is an area that I spend a lot of time. And things like disruption, right, are very like thrown around all over the place. But no one ever stops to say, well, hang on, what if the money's broken?
Yeah.
And it was such a big moment for me when I was like, it's actually safety, and you triggered me there, talking about Bitcoin obsolete central banks. You're like, whoa, okay, that's actually massive. And what does that mean? So I'd love to learn more about like the companies that you exited and a bit more about life perhaps before Bitcoin and what skills you had from that that helped you actually eventually see Bitcoin.
Yeah, I think I'll generalize it a bit more as to like what I learned from, I always kind of describe this as like exploring ideas and trying to figure out if they have any merit, basically. Mm. So I was always interested, you know, when I was younger, like on the internet, like seeing what are people actually building? Like, what are they spending time on? Only later I realized kind of like the profoundness of time and taking risk and having limited energy and all these things like true Bitcoin. But yeah, I was always interested, like, why do you spend time on a certain thing? Or when I heard an idea and I thought that was a stupid idea, I don't know. I'm wired to then think like, yeah, but if this person is spending their time and energy on it, then maybe I'm wrong. Maybe they're super wrong and it really sucks, right? But could also be that I'm wrong in my judgment of whatever the idea is that I saw. And I think that's what really triggered me to kind of like go deeper into, like internet startup land. So I started my working life at the Next Web, which is like a technology blog and like conference. And I worked on an investor side. I had my own growth marketing agency, consulted with a lot of entrepreneurs and teams, and also worked in TradFi on like the innovation department. So I think I've tried out thousands of products, and I've worked with I think over 200 teams and entrepreneurs in like really the early stages, right?
Wow.
And I think what I really got from that was really thinking like, can I build this or should I build this? And I think this eventually also translates into what I think is wrong with crypto and why, for example, pump.fun actually killed crypto, but we'll get to that. But yeah, can I build this versus should I build this? And actually, can I build this? If you're looking at all the AI stuff right now, the whole vibe coding, like I can just come up with an idea on my phone with my AI and it builds an iOS app, right? And so the point is, yeah, can I build a thing or should I build a thing? And should I build a thing really goes kind of like into the reason of existence. Like, why should this exist? Are there enough people that have a certain problem or a need that should be actually be serviced, right? Where they are also open to pay for it and all these things. And only then you can actually build or should build the thing. At least that's my kind of like philosophy. But many people approach technology as like, well, there's this thing I can use and I'm just going to build it. And in general, in startup land, that's the same, right? Like startup land with VC investing, et cetera, is really a zero sum fiat game. It's like, it's a numbers game. You know, if you invest in 100 companies, one or two return all the investments of the other 98 on average, right? So over a long enough time frame. And so when you think about that, like, the money is so broken, if we tie this into the money, right? There are actually people that are playing this game of trying to find ideas, you know, and in general, I'd say investing and trying stuff out, of course, that is necessary. But the entire VC game is so, I don't want to say corrupted, but, I said it.
it is, though. From
you know, it doesn't incentivize, like, if you have a lot of money.
How do you finance innovation?
Yeah, so if you have a lot of money and no boundaries, that makes you less creative, which makes you more prone to, well, I have the money, I'm just going to build the thing because this guy or woman, you know, gave me the money because I had a great pitch where all my charts went up and to the right and I presented that in a great way, for example. But I've learned along the way that, you know, ideas are cheap. Like, I believe that, you know, all the ideas, all the knowledge is already out there in the ether. And sometimes an idea strikes you and you're like, oh my God, I'm a genius. I should do something with that, right? Or like late in the evening when you have an idea and you're like, oh, that's a great idea. Well, I'm going to go to bed now. And then in the morning, you know, I'll do something with it. That obviously never happens. So the point is, yeah, once you have an idea, you have to do something. Ideas are just very cheap. Like, we could now brainstorm for an hour and have 10 great business ideas. Like, that's super fun. But
and we'd be the Bram and Jake agency, you know, whatever, pumping out startups called whatever. Yeah. We have an AI focus and whatever. Yeah.
something AI blockchain. Right. But that's not productive. So you have to. So ideas are cheap. It's really all about execution. And because there are so many ideas, just having that realization. What I learned and what I taught other people is that, okay, if you have an idea that you're enthusiastic about, you instantly give yourself the challenge to figure out as quickly as possible whether you should spend more time, money, and energy on it. And if the answer is no, you just move on to the next idea because an idea itself is just worthless. To kind of go a few steps back. So what I've seen is there are people that work on ideas that shouldn't really exist, but they are kind of still working on it because they're incentivized by this game of VC and having money, etc. And so they are kind of putting their time and energy on the wrong thing without actually realizing what kind of like game they are playing. And yeah, there you kind of see the similarity as what I just said in the beginning, right? Like, that's the same for us as an individual, just in the financial system, basically. Something has been taught to us and we are just following this game, but it's not the most productive thing that we could do, like not in an economic sense, but also not in a spiritual sense, because eventually if you have a limited time and energy that you can give to the world in the limited time that you're here, wouldn't you want to spend that on like the most promising, productive possible outcome that there is, right? And I think to actually do that, you need agency that can only come from yourself, right? And there's so many outside influences, especially when it comes to finance, money, etc., that I think not many people are aware of. And so being in that world, I think, kind of primed me to eventually really get Bitcoin, because I think there's a lot of talent and energy that's wasted on, just the wrong ideas. And wrong ideas are fine. They are needed. But you have to be honest about the fact that if you have an idea, even if you spend $1 million on it because you had funding, if it sucks, it sucks. That's totally okay. Right. But just, kind of like humbling yourself to that degree and being honest about that, I think that's the biggest achievement you can probably get to. Right. Like, okay, I thought this was a great idea. I did all the work. Eventually, nobody really wants it. Right. There's no market need. Okay. That's fine. I move on to the other thing and not trying to make something out of nothing that shouldn't really exist. That was a big ramble. I hope that makes sense.
It's brilliant, Bram. What I love is basically people who've worked that kind of intersection of like new ideas, finance, and an exit. It's a good word for it. Liquidity. It's like, okay, how do you put money into something early, take big risk, but then get big reward if it goes well? And there's a model that's been the status quo for quite some time that when you start actually digging into what it means when there's a money printer, you realize a lot of that early stage money was only there because they were closer to the fiat money.
Yes.
You know, the monetary spigot, right? These massive VC firms that are getting huge Series A, Series B funding rounds. Like I read the founder of SoftBank's book recently, which was fascinating about like how he actually built the Vision Fund and all these different structures in that I'd never heard of before, where he was basically paying a yield to the oil states in the Saudi Arabia and the Middle East for $100 billion. He was paying them 7% a year, like a bond, in order to have all this money to then spend on all these early stage companies trying to make it all back. I mean, absolutely extraordinary scale that they were doing that at. But where I get, I guess, a bit confused is I'm like, how does this world change on a sound money standard?
Mm-hmm.
And in some ways, I have to look at my own experience. Like I did make some early stage investments in 2018, 2019, roughly. And then Bitcoin just hit me like a ton of bricks. And I basically looked at selling as much of everything else I can and reallocating into Bitcoin. And it's like Bitcoin is an idea that's so big that it just kind of gobbles you up. And you're just like, I couldn't not get involved.
Mm-hmm.
But you can look at it from that kind of almost early stage perspective still in terms of like the growth that's ahead and the total addressable market and all these kind of like different lenses you can apply to an early stage project. But then at the same time, it's like it's replacing a US treasury. It's like the lowest risk reward that exists. And it's so interesting to me. It's like, well, what's going to happen in the future with ideas? And ideas are cheap.
Love that.
But like, how do you fund a good idea?
Yes.
When the cost of capital is compound annual growth rate 50%.
Yes. Amazing question. Yes. Love this. So
I'm all up for VC, right? Like we should be putting money into 100%. Early stage things. No. But like, how?
If you denominate it in Bitcoin, so this is a great question.
Yeah,
so
I love this.
I'll try to do my best. So what I just said, if ideas are cheap. And they are cheap because they are abundant, right? Mm-hmm. All the information that ever existed is already out there. And sometimes, you know, you get a little download and you have an idea. But an idea is nothing more than kind of like a combination of lots of different assumptions that you have, right? I always describe it like this, like, okay, I have an idea, which is usually a thing that exists in the future, right? Like mm-hmm. It doesn't exist now. So I have an idea for a product or a service that does XYZ. For these people that have this problem that I can find in this place and they're going to pay me this much money and then this is my profit, you know, something like that. If you ask someone, pitch me your idea, they usually pitch the solution. Not many people actually pitch like, I'm going to build something for XYZ target group that has ABC problem, right? And along the way, I'm going to figure out how to actually mold and shape this solution so it really, really fits them basically. And so if ideas are really cheap, you have to be super, super rigorous in your validation, right? In the beginning, that 0 to 1 stage where you basically figure out, okay, is this something that should exist? How right or wrong am I with all my assumptions that make up this idea with regards to what the people that have the problem or the need that I want to service actually want. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
So I have an idea, but I'm probably wrong. So I need to go out into the world and get information to figure out how wrong or right I am. And based on that information, I have to decide if I should continue or not. But that's not only for the people that I want to service, that's also for me, because I have limited time and energy and attention and motivation that I can point towards a certain idea. And so it's not only to figure out, so it's kind of like this parallel path, right? So you're figuring out the validity or the merit, basically, of your idea. It's very practical. It's just information, right? I need to get information in the shortest amount of time possible. So how can I learn the most in the shortest amount of time? And then along the way, you know, does that information actually translate to an opportunity that I would want to spend my limited time, energy, and resources on, basically? And eventually you want to get to a point where you can say, like, hell yes, right? Like, it's either a hell yes or hell no. And so I'd say that that process naturally exists or should exist. Like, people should be aware of that, because why would you want to spend your limited time, energy, and resources on an idea that just sucks, right? Like, why would you want to do that? So that naturally exists. So you have natural kind of like boundaries to be creative and figure shit out in, again, the shortest amount of time possible. Because if it's a idea, if the idea sucks, you want to discard it and move on to a next idea. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, okay. Kill ideas quickly was a phrase I used to use.
Yeah. So you have these natural limitations, but what if there's someone that comes along and it gives you 500K in fiat money and it's like, oh yeah, that's a great idea. This is my seed funding and blah, blah. The boundaries disappear, you know, when people start hiring other people to do the research, to do the sales and all these things to learn, basically. So the money is learning capital to that degree. To, in many cases, because most ideas suck, and that's okay. Just spend way more money and way more time and way more energy on something that could have been killed, respectfully, you know, way, way, way earlier. And so the fleeting money, right? The debasing money kind of dissolves these boundaries. Whereas with Bitcoin, if you introduce Bitcoin, and there's a term I learned recently, which is like the hurdle rate, right? Mm-hmm. If Bitcoin is your hurdle rate,
great phrase.
If Bitcoin is the hardest thing you can ever own, the most precious thing you could ever own, then you have to be very diligent about what you're spending it on. And so that actually, I would say, enforces the natural boundaries that are already there, you know, that I just explained. And therefore actually force you to be very rigid in doing your kind of like validation and due diligence around an idea, because you really want to be super, super, super certain that this is something that has merit, that should exist, that there's people that have a certain problem or have a certain need that should be serviced, before you actually start using the Bitcoin as capital to execute on the idea.
So cool, isn't it? So basically the access to early stage financing has just got a whole lot harder. But for people that actually try to do it, the incentive is in place such that they will have done probably 10 times more work to figure out it's actually what they want to do before even saying it, right?
Yes. You cannot bullshit it anymore, basically. Like what I said just jokingly now, like I've seen many, many, many investment pitches. It's always a great story. There's always people that have a problem. All the charts go up and to the right, and the market is huge and blah, blah, blah. Like that, it's like a beauty pageant to a degree. Mm. That's always how I describe the startup competitions and stuff like that, right? Like who has the best pitch? No. Who has the best fucking business opportunity? Yeah. You know, like that's what it's
that
about.
That gets forgotten. Yeah.
Yeah.
And then can you pump the next round? Can you bring in a bigger fund that wants a higher price? Yeah. And then you're actually playing a game such that don't run out of money, but make sure you can get another funding round at a superior valuation.
Yeah.
And you're basically fixing
your
market
in the game.
Yeah.
No, you're a subject in the game. You're not a player. So when you start with your idea and your company, you're a player. You want to create something in the world, right?
And then when you become a bit part of it,
When you get that funding, you know, of some you know, early stage VC fund, like there's two things. They need to get fund two or three or whatever off the ground, right? Like in the next 2, 3, 4 years. So they need some results. And so they're pushing you for growth, right? For example, when this was nice when I realized this. Many people say like, oh, we have this and that amount of users, right? Like we have 100,000 users. But then if you ask them like, what is a user? They don't really have a definition, right? Is that registrations?
Yeah, what is that, sign up?
So is that an active user? Yeah, exactly. Like, and what is an active user, right? Mm. Like, what do they actually bring you? What did it cost you to actually acquire all these people? Because we can run advertising. Yeah, we can run advertising campaigns and get like 1 million signups to whatever the startup is that we're building. But that doesn't say anything. So then if you go back to your early stage VC and be like, hey, we got 1 million signups, you know, there's something here. And then that VC goes to, you know, whoever's their funding and say like, hey, we got this company in the portfolio. They have 1 million signups, whatever, and blah, blah. Oh, yeah, sure. We'll fund you fund number three, right? So it's a weird, like that VC is literally a Ponzi scheme in that sense, or a pyramid, one of the two.
They wouldn't like hearing that.
No, I know.
But to some degree, that's true, though. When you start digging into what Bitcoin actually is and you look at it in comparison to where you've been before and you start to see misalignment everywhere of incentive,
yeah.
And then you suddenly start to see incentive alignment everywhere. It's kind of putting the hair up on the back of my head. It's like, this is the way to go.
Yes.
It's so obvious.
Yeah. And if we want to make the point is not to like hate on VCs or whatever. It's to, I hope inspire people to, if you think about this, and maybe even if you work in finance or VC, kind of like humble yourself and just when you see the game for what it is, the biggest realization I think you should have is like you said, it's misalignment, but it's also misallocation of finite time and energy of other humans, right? So if you think about if Bitcoin is the hurdle rate and we are forced to be very diligent with what we are spending our capital on, then that what we are actually spending our capital on is going to be very directional, very substantiated. A great foundation. That doesn't mean that there also should be capital to just fuck around and try stuff and do weird things and be creative like that, you know, play around to discover stuff. But that can only work if you actually designate a certain amount of money to only do that, right? So just be very conscious about where you put the economic energy towards, and I think that is the core of what we're talking about, and I think that Bitcoin brings that if you view Bitcoin as the hurdle rate.
And so Prem, your pod with Robert Breedlove, I've definitely got through like a large part of it, and I've got written down as my second bullet point before we started the call, spirituality, and the quick conversation we had before we clicked record is that was something that you've really enjoyed picking up through this journey that you're. And I would be lying if I didn't say the same thing, like completely unexpected part of what this has been about. But where it has an impact in what we're discussing here is something I'd like to get your view on. So you talked about this idea of like, okay, I've got an idea. Here's the target market. Here's the size of the market. Here's the actual user. Here's their acute problem. Here's all the people I went and spoke to about it. Like supposedly de-risking an idea, right? And, you know, then you should give me 150 grand to go and build an MVP and I'll show you how it's going to be amazing. It's a constant process of iteration to get supposed market feedback. But to your point, you're already using time and energy that probably wouldn't have been put into this idea had it been on a Bitcoin standard. So maybe it's already a waste. But I used to think along the lines of a kind of very scientific process in terms of like what's a good business idea and then iterate and take action and find out if that's true. But the more that I've got into the spiritual side of what this sound money revolution is this idea of basically an increase in your consciousness and the ability to vibrate at a higher frequency that genuinely like changes your life. Like your decision making changes, the people that you meet change, like the people that you, by definition, evolve from, you leave behind quite naturally. And It's not that that's right or wrong, but I've started learning about this idea that ideas themselves are bits of information that exist that are always looking for a way to get into existence. And so they are almost like, if you think of it, in the ether. Mm-hmm. And like you already said, like all the ideas are already out there, but the person that expresses that idea is the person in the right place at the right time. And so maybe all of this customer discovery stuff is bullshit. And you have to just dig right down in inside yourself, like, what do I actually want?
Mm.
And it's much more about the building.
I like
and
that.
It will come.
Yes, yes.
And it's because you're able to operate with a lower time preference. You're able to plan better for the future. You can still have kids, own your Bitcoin, not freak out that you're not going to have any money tomorrow, and go and build shit that you actually want. How does that jam for you in comparison to that world that we were kind of discussing?
Mm. I agree that what Bitcoin has brought me as well is just like way more alignment and intention as to like what I'm spending my time and energy on. And I agree with you. And also what I just said, yeah, like I believe that all the information that was ever there and will ever exist already exists, right?
Mm.
And so that's why an idea is not unique. Bitcoin existed before we've actually seen it, before it's manifested in the world. And I think
that's the idea of a discovery versus an invention.
Yes.
It just so happened to put all the pieces together at the same time. So now it's been discovered.
Yeah, the combination of these elements put together and actually taken from the more metaphysical space to our physical reality, right? Which for me is manifestation, in a sense that, you know, if I have an idea, it's nothing. If I say it or speak it, then it starts to become something, right? If I then write it down and I do research and I get more information and I work on it, you know, and I sharpen it and all these things, then that is actually what for me manifestation is. Like I'm creating it in the world that, you know, our perceivement of reality, basically. So I agree. I don't really agree with the like build it and they will come. I think it's more about if you are truly aligned with what you're doing, then you will also be okay with failure of an idea, right? So if you're aligned with what you want to spend your time and energy on, and you're honest and you're constantly challenging yourself to humble yourself, right? So for example, if you have an idea, there are many people that think like, whoa, I'm a fucking genius. I'm the only person in the world that has this idea, right? Like, oh, I'm so fucking smart, blah, 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 blah. But my starting point is the opposite, which is I'm probably wrong and this idea sucks. But I think it's interesting enough to spend a little time on to see if it actually has some merit, right? What we just talked about before.
Mm.
And in that way, from the starting point, you are already a bit more honest about the fact that it probably exists, right? Like idea validation is not about proving the idea is a good idea. It's about proving it's not a bad idea. So it's the other way around. So if you agree that there are just an infinite amount of ideas, then numbers-wise, your specific idea probably sucks in the shape that it, you know, came to you as a download. And if you find it interesting, you have to figure out if you're not wrong. It's the other way around.
Hmm. Interesting. And so that actually does like flip that slightly, doesn't it? So it's not about just doing it because, so the real world feedback remains critical.
Yeah.
But the important step then being is the honesty. So it's like, actually, this is telling me this isn't working. But with the more fiat minded kind of funding process, you can be dishonest for longer, essentially.
Yeah because you have are no boundaries to be that rigid, right? So okay, someone gives me $500K in seed funding, okay, I have a 2-year burn rate to figure this out, you know. And I mean, I've had projects in like the TradFi jobs I've had, for example, with I worked with another guy on we were like they called it like the innovation coach. Like we were kind of like the objective, annoying guys when it came to like, judging the concepts and the initiatives that were being worked on. And we once did like an analysis of like a portfolio where they already spent like a few million on several ideas. And we went through them in like a week, totally dissected that, And then just basically present it like, yeah, this should have been, all should have been killed like over a year ago. And I think that is the core of what we are talking about. It's just such a pity to waste your time and money on the wrong idea. But if it's not your money, then you feel like, especially in that TradFi environment, for example, if it's not your money and there's just space and time, yeah, then sure, why not? I'm just going to fuck around. I get a 200K a year and a bonus. And then, yeah, like, why should I even think about being more rigid? Does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely. And so much of where we're going, we obviously don't know yet. Like, it's absolutely true, in my experience at least, that very few people in the world understand Bitcoin to this extent. Yes, you might walk into a room now and like 90% of people will put their hand up if you say, have you heard of Bitcoin? Mm-hmm. But if you then say, how many of you have got over 50% of your net wealth in self-custody, and you might be lucky to get one hand. So like actual meaningful use of it remains extremely early, in my opinion. And with that, the actual ramifications of how the economy works, we haven't even really started. So I'm intrigued as to like where you think we're at in that sense. Obviously, having been involved in innovation, you're looking at technology trends. It wouldn't have been a surprise to you that obviously when you came across Bitcoin, it's a technology. Of course, you can start to analyze it with some of those previous tools that you had. Are we still ridiculously early, or like are we starting to see faster adoption? Everyone has such a different take on this.
Maybe to start with, to tie it back to what I said in the beginning, why I think Pump.fun killed crypto. So if you really study Bitcoin, then at least my realization is that it's actually a fairly simple and dumb thing, right? Like it's a computer protocol that says, this is how I work, you know, and you can adopt me. And when you adopt me, you actually help enforcing the rules of my protocol. And the way that it's adopted is in a decentralized way. Anyone can adopt it, right? Anyone can mine, anyone can run a node, etc. That's basically it. It's basically like a computer rule system that people can adopt. And because they adopt it, they can actually make use of it. And what is the make use of it part is to send and receive these eventually limited units of a Bitcoin. I see you nod. So that makes a little sense. But that, I think it's as simple as that. That's literally it.
That idea that it's a pet rock and it just hasn't changed.
Yeah. Yes, it's just a thing. So when also, side note, when people say like, oh, it's not, you cannot buy a coffee, whatever, like, if you have your house for sale and I want to buy your house and I say, can I pay you in Bitcoin? You can say yes. And we transact the Bitcoin in freedom, basically. Like it is a medium of exchange. The fact that not many people understand that, that's another thing. You cannot force that understanding and that adoption, etc. So for me, Bitcoin is in that sense very, you know, underlying, it's very complicated, right? But the use case, the thing that it is that you see that you can adopt is very straightforward. And in my mind, the entire idea of Bitcoin is to uphold the integrity of the ledger. That's it. So the ledger, the Bitcoin ledger, the time chain is the truth of Bitcoin. And from that truth, a lot of things are derived, actually, that have value. But the most important thing is to keep that truth the truth, to not compromise it, basically. And as long as that time chain truth stays the truth, we can actually use Bitcoin in all the ways that I think, you know, people are talking about. And so the most important things to keep the truth are the having it stay decentralized and secure. This is what Jeff Booth always says, and I fully agree with him. And so that, you know, if you go to the blockchain trilemma, is decentralization, security, speed. There is a whole technical, I think, great explanation. I think it's from Jack Mahler, who talks about like speed of light and why the transactions of Bitcoin are what they are. Anyway, what technologists have done is look at Bitcoin and say like, oh, I can make this faster. Oh, look at my throughput per transactions per second. I have, you know, million, billion, gazillion, whatever. You know, and then you get a Solana and an Ethereum, et cetera, et cetera. And that's exactly that mentality of could I build this and not should I build this? Because if you stuck with the should I build this like the other thing, or should I build on Bitcoin? Is this the thing that I should pay attention on? It's a very easy trap and a logical trap to think about the, can I build this? Because that's more fun. It's more fun to fuck around and tinker if you're technical and all these things like, oh, I should, you know, I can build this other thing. So I'm going to do that. And the interesting part there is that we've now come to a stage where we had Ethereum, which was like the supercomputer. You know, then we had ICOs, right? ICOs had a business plan and they had that token. And it was like, I was funding 20 neobanks. They all don't exist, you know? So yeah, I'm funding the new technology and blah, blah. Like I thought like that. Then it became NFTs, which was like that went from business plan to one pager, white paper. They even steal the term, like it's a one pager for this project and it's amazing and community and blah, blah. And then we went on to meme coins. It's all the same thing, literally the same thing, but just a little narrative change. And like a meme coin is literally like, we can start JCoin now. Mm. Yeah. And then someone was like, oh, well, if meme coins are the thing right now, I think I should build pump.fun, right? Where people can just easily create a meme coin. Now there are like 50,000 coins launching every day or every week. I don't even know the number. And that, I think, is a perfect example of showing like the fact that you can build this doesn't mean you should, because pump.fun is really diluting all the narratives. It's all just narratives in the crypto space, basically. And so I recently read this, like crypto is like a Faustian bargain, right? Once you get to Bitcoin and you think like, okay, this could be interesting, there is a lot of work that you need to do to actually understand why it's existing. And that's why crypto is so tempting in the sense that, you know, Ripple is a dollar or whatever, or the whole unit bias, right? Or it's faster, stuff like that. It's just surface level stuff that attracts people to the quicker thing, which is, you know, totally fine. That's normal. But I think that will eventually, yeah, kind of like implode. I mean, pump.fun is not going away. So how are you going to keep all these narratives alive? Whereas, you know, the narrative or what we talk about with Bitcoin, what I just said, it's just a very, very simple thing. The thing itself is simple. The use case is simple. And the use case right now, and later it's medium of exchange, it's just, it's superior savings technology. Why do you need that? Because you literally cannot save anymore. You know what we talked about in the beginning. Mm. So the reason of existence for Bitcoin is very clear. The way that it's, you know, engineered and maintained and distributed and all these things has also become clear. It's more and more emergent, right? Hash rate keeps going up, etc. Like the adoption is growing, even with like thousands and thousands of alternatives, right? And so I wanted to add that before we go to, are we still early? Yeah, I think we are still ridiculously early. I have a question I ask sometimes in my podcast, like how many people do you think I don't think you can fully understand Bitcoin, but just the profoundness of it, right? The fact that the profoundness for me is like that it's a mirror to this fiat money system. You know, it's not a hedge or whatever. It's a totally different system. It's literally you move your economic energy from one system to another system, and you move your mind with it, etc. What we talked about. And so, yeah, I like to ask people that question, and I wonder what your number is. But I honestly think it's like 100K, 100,000 people maybe. Talk to some people that I think are very smart. They say like 10,000. So I don't know. I think we are ridiculously early. I call Bitcoin an asymmetric opportunity based on publicly available information. Like all the information is out there. You can verify and study Bitcoin for yourself. Mm. I mean, the American government, whatever you think of the American government, is talking about adopting Bitcoin as a strategic reserve. You know, in Qatar, there's a billion dollar mining facility. Like Bhutan is mining Bitcoin with government resources. Like all these things are happening. So there are people that are seeing it. But I think that's a central topic that we are talking about. Like you have to humble yourself. Like you don't know shit. I didn't know shit before. You know, I worked at a bank. I was 30. I had a mortgage. I was into Bitcoin. And then I had a colleague tell me, did you know the money in the bank is not yours? And I was like, what are you talking about? You know? And we talked about that for an hour. I walked away and I felt like an idiot. Like, what am I doing? So step one is humble yourself. You don't know shit. You have to do the work. And if you don't do the work, you will stay a subject in this financial system, right? And that has second, third, fourth order effects, I think, that we also mentioned on your individual life that you think is most important. And so, yes, I do think we are still very early. Years ago, we fantasized about 100K would break the internet, right? America adopting Bitcoin, we would be at 1 million Bitcoin. Like, all these things, all the bullish stuff that's happening right now that speaks for Bitcoin, that also removes all the risk that Bitcoin had of going to zero, et cetera, that's basically gone. I mean, all that information is out there, so I don't really know what to say to that. But I think we are still super early. If we're at 86,000 with all that information available, then we are extremely early.
And that's where I like to reflect on, basically, it's pure luck. So I think from speaking to people, I feel there's maybe like three minimum, more like five very serious things that happen in someone's life that when you combine them together, meant that they were like, hang on, this Bitcoin thing really might make sense. And everyone has a different Bitcoin journey. And that's why I love asking these questions, because it's just so interesting how people piece the puzzle together to go, actually, I better start looking at this. But you're right. All the podcasts are out there. All the books are out there. Mm-hmm. You just got to find it and go and look at it.
And sorry to interrupt, but what you just said is a signal by itself. How are so many people from so many different walks of life, backgrounds, ages, religion, races, all these things that do not matter in Bitcoin? Why do they all converge to Bitcoin? Why is one of Mexican's richest men, Ricardo Salinas, he's a billionaire. The majority of his wealth is in Bitcoin. Hello, you know, like, if that is not a signal to at least,
hello,
you know, don't blindly buy it. But, you know, that's the part of the humble yourself. Be like, why is he doing that? You know, and the easy cop out is saying, yeah, he's a fucking idiot. But then, yeah, you're the idiot. What I mean? Like, so that has been very important for me along the way, just seeing certain people talk in a certain way about Bitcoin. For example, I always bring up Greg Foss. I love Greg Foss.
Yeah.
In his Twitter bio, he has like something like, I spent 35 years in a risk chair. And I read that when I was 35. And then I just realized, what the fuck do I know? After I heard him talk for one of the first times, and then I looked at his bio and I was like, he makes sense. And then when I look at his track record, I'm like, what do I have to counter against him after I heard him say a lot of rational stuff that I actually agree with? The reason of existence of Bitcoin, understanding that you're a subject in a financial system not designed to improve your individual life, is rough, man. Like, that is that's not a great thing to accept, you know? But once you accept that, the doors open things up, basically. And
it's kind of like, Bram, when you said with an idea, you should be always saying, why is my idea a bad idea? Rather than, why is my idea a good idea?
Mm-hmm.
In relation to Bitcoin, why we're all talking about it a lot of the time is it's like, someone somewhere tell me why this thing doesn't work. And the more you ask those questions, like, why is Bitcoin a bad idea, the more that you struggle to find the answer, if that makes sense.
That sounds like a snake oil salesman, but it's true. No, but I mean, like, it's a
Sailor. I'm not trying to pump my own bag.
No. Yeah,
it's like, someone somewhere tell me why this is a terrible idea, and I'll listen.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. Well, Michael Saylor says, you know, there are no informed critiques. I mean, if you study this for 50 hours and you still think it sucks and you have reasonable arguments, please call me.
Yeah.
I haven't seen it. All the people that are against Bitcoin are super emotional or don't know what they're talking about. And I mean, I'm not saying I know everything, but I know I did the work to understand why this thing should exist. Yesterday, actually, I talked to Ken Sim, who's the mayor of Vancouver, and he has a wager he put out there, like, I will pay anyone $1 million Canadian if they can give me sound, rational arguments as to why Bitcoin sucks. And he said, no one has taken the bait.
Yeah.
So that says a lot. And, you know, if you go on LinkedIn or Twitter and there's like all these Twitter critics, you know, I just usually reply like, please post an image of your massive, massive shorts, right?
Yeah.
Because, yeah, just put your money where your mouth is. You know, I'm all in on Bitcoin. So what are you doing? You know?
Yeah. And I love that. Like, ask a man what he owns, not what he thinks. Is a very,
that's
very
easy. Ideas are cheap. We talked about that, right?
Yeah.
So, yeah.
And speaking of which, like, I'm trying to make, well, from an investment perspective, Bitcoin is so exciting that it tends to like take up most of my bandwidth, to be honest. Mm-hmm. But there are different ways of investing time in different areas of your life. Two areas I want to ask about is like, one, family life for you. How different might it be looking forwards with Bitcoin in the background? Maybe get to that second. But the first is like, you started a podcast. Mm-hmm. Why did you decide to invest in starting a podcast?
I think that ties back to what I shared when we started talking, right? So why is Bitcoin for millennials? Like, when I started thinking about that, that actually came naturally after I just realized that I really want to contribute to this thing. And I heard Bob Burnett. I don't know if you know him. He's a Boomer BTC on,
I've seen his stuff,
Twitter.
Yeah.
And I don't know, he's in his 60s, right? He's a boomer. He's in his 60s somewhere. And he was on a podcast and he said something like, yeah, Bitcoin is the biggest thing that you could put your energy and time towards. Like, it's the most exciting and promising thing. And then when I listened to that, so that was like, I don't know, 20 months ago or something, I realized that, yeah, I'm going to think about this thing for the rest of my life. You know, wow. I wake up and I think about Bitcoin. And then because he said that, I was like, yeah, I should contribute to this. And then I started thinking about, okay, like how, and then I had a few conversations with friends and we talked about money and Bitcoin. And yeah, what I shared in the beginning, many friends that, for example, one friend, he doesn't like it, but I had to use him as an example. He saw this company, multi-millions, and it's all in a bank, and he didn't own any Bitcoin, and we went on a golf trip together, like 2 hours in the car, and I told him, like, we're gonna talk about Bitcoin, bro. Like, you are stuck now, right? I used a totally wrong approach. That's not the point. I learned from that. But I realized that someone that I love and think is super intelligent has no clue about money and doesn't think it's a problem that he spent multiple years of his life creating a company, then selling it, then putting all the rewards in a place where he doesn't really own it anymore.
Mm.
And when I saw that with him, I was like, damn, dude, like, okay, this is not about your intelligence. This is about something else. And I think that was the biggest trigger for me to combined with, you know, I want to do something for Bitcoin. To be like, okay, yeah, well, why not start another podcast?
Nice.
And I think it's great you're starting too. Like, I don't think there's enough podcasts because, yeah, we all talk to different people in a different way, right? So in ways that I explain my thought process resonate with certain people differently than how you explain it. And I think that is a great thing. And if there's only 100,000 people that understand the profoundness, we have a very long way to go. So I applaud anyone who starts a podcast or writes a book or whatever. Like, try to reach people in your way, and you will see that if you just keep on doing that, like, that resonates with certain people, and you will get the messages from people that share with them, like, hey, how you talked about this actually made it click for me. And like, that is the best feeling ever, basically, because then you know two things. I think you were doing other people a service. You're helping them, guiding them in a sense to, you know, where should I actually put my time and attention. But it's also validation for the fact that you were talking about it in a certain way that actually makes sense, you know. And I think that's really helped me to just realize that, I'm not the crazy guy screaming about Bitcoin in the desert. Like, there's many, many people that are focusing their time and energy on it. And it's just really rewarding. And again, yeah, I think this is the most important topic that anyone should understand.
And Bram, it's that you talked about downloading essentially. It's like, it's so true. Like the downloading session that we've essentially done over the last hour or so is the same thing. So people will get different stuff from it. I just wanted to touch on, so we had a call booked a few weeks ago and you couldn't make it because I believe you became a parent for the second time. Is that correct? Mm-hmm. Yeah, cool. Congrats on that. That's absolutely Thank awesome. You. Do you think that you think differently because of living on a Bitcoin standard when it comes to parenting? I mean, this is probably a whole nother fucking podcast, right? But
yeah,
to just touch on it, final question, I'd love to get your thoughts around how that might have shifted you.
Yeah, when you just mentioned that, I had to think of a tweet. I looked it up that I had.
Go on.
When you adopt Bitcoin, you stop running the rat race and start walking your own path. And yeah, I feel nice. Like that is really my life. And eventually, I had a discussion about this week. Like, it doesn't matter how much Bitcoin you have. That's not the point. The fact that you realize, you know, what we talked about for the past hour, taking agency, humbling yourself and being like, okay, how am I going to get off this rat race and create a path, right? The path is not there. You have to create your path yourself. So I don't think that's necessarily about how much Bitcoin you have or how much money and stuff like that. But it's like, what is this path? What are the things in my path? Who am I taking? You know, where is it going? Like all these things. And I think that is what Bitcoin really gave me. And now, yeah, so having children, it's I feel like I'm way more present. Yesterday, I was walking with my baby, and I don't know, I just walked for 2 hours on a 2 p.m. on a Monday, and I was calling with one of my best friends. I was like, well, what the hell? You know, I can actually do that. Yeah. You know, so it's funny that... and I know it's super privileged and all those things, that's all true, but
it's reality for you.
That's yeah, exactly. Thing. So I think it's good to share as an example, like that is what the freedom is about. The freedom is not about the money. The freedom is about your creating time. Your own path and whatever that path is, like whatever you want to do. Right. Mm.
It's a radical reevaluation of the value of your time. Yep. That's what it enables. And when you go through that process, you realize you're going to make a whole ton of different choices. But that is
life in general. Yes, good point. But that is life in general. But I think it's getting to the point where, and you are not always in control, but that you feel more in control, that you can make conscious choices about what to spend your time and energy on. Again, whatever you want to do. Or wherever you want to live, or you know, whatever. That's not what it's about. It's more about actually getting to the point where you are consciously making that decision. I think that is what the freedom is about.
Awesome. Well, very inspiring spot to finish up. Bram, thank you so much for your time today. That's been awesome to chat for the first time and learn about basically a lot of the ways that you think. I think it's fantastic. Where can people head if they want to reach out?
Yeah, well, I appreciate those words, and I appreciate the invite. I think you should come on my pod, and we can continue the conversation.
We will. We will. Absolutely.
Where people can find me is mainly on X. My handle is Bramk. That's Bramk. That's the same on YouTube, Substack, and people can find the podcast. It's called Bitcoin for Millennials on YouTube. And Spotify, awesome. Apple, or wherever you get your podcast.
Well, guys, go check it out. Bram, thank you so much for today.
Thanks, brother. Cheers.